Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of the New Books Network, and our guest today is Stephanie Hoffman, who has translated a pretty large memoir of a guy by the name of Julius Margolin, who survived a number of Soviet work camps. So thank you for being here with us today, Stephanie.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So could you start off by telling us a bit about yourself, how you came to do a translation project like this, how you got interested in the subject overall?
Okay. Well, my field, my academic field was both Russian literature and Soviet and Russian intellectual history. And I worked at the Hebrew University Mayrock Center for many years. I've also done various translations of people, mainly Soviet Jewish activists who were in Soviet camps, such as Natan Sharansky, Hillel Budman, the Leningrad hijacking, and others. I must say, I read this particular book many years ago in the 70s when I was working on a project dealing with several memoirs of Soviet labor camps. And at the time, I read only an abridged version. But nevertheless, I felt that this was the most powerful book of the many that I read. And I wanted to bring this book, share it with English readers. It was only available in Russian at the time. So I was very happy when the opportunity came later, and by that time, a more fuller version had been published in other languages, which I felt was gave an even better picture of both who Margolin was and of the camp experience.
So do you think because Margolin is not quite as much of a household name in the English speaking world like Solzhenitsyn is, I was wondering if maybe you could just hold forth for a bit on who the author of this memoir is. Where's he coming from? What's his background? I think that'd be kind of helpful for people listening in.
Yes, I think so. Julius Margolin had a very rich life, full of tumultuous and traumatic events in the 20th century. He was born in 1900 in Pinsk, which was then part of the Jewish area of settlement of the Russian Empire. He, in fact, was educated in the Russian language and Russian culture, he also spoke Polish and Yiddish and had great respect for Polish culture and Jewish culture. His early education was in schools in the Russian Empire, and then he furthered his education by going to Germany, where he studied philosophy at the University of Berlin and started in 1923 and received his PhD in 1929. While he was there, he met and married a fellow philosophy student named Eva Spector, and they had a son there. And later, after he received his PhD, they moved to Łódź in Polish, but we'll call it Łódź. There he worked as a journalist and writer and met Zev Jabotinsky and became involved in his Beitar movement and Zionism, the movement to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In fact, following that ideology, in 1936, he moved his wife and son to Tel Aviv in British Mandate, Palestine. But in order to have the money to pay for a British residency permit, he agreed to work for a relative managing a factory in Łódź, in Poland. And the agreement, according to the agreement, he would finish his job September 3rd, 1939. Well, as we all know, 2 days before that, the Nazis invaded Poland and World War II started, and he was caught. And the war was basically total chaos. People just, the Poles were shocked at the invasion itself and at the incompetence of their government and army. And Margolin, feeling trapped, of course, tried to escape, but he failed. In fact, at the beginning of the book, there is a map which traces his zigzag efforts to get out, cross any border, Romania, Lithuania, but it all failed. He managed, he was caught then on September 17th, the Soviet Union also invaded Poland. And at that time he was in the area which the Soviets invaded, and he was still trapped and he still tried frantically to escape. Eventually, the Soviets, contending that Poland was no longer a country, tried to force everyone in their sector to accept Soviet citizenship. Margolin refused, and this eventually resulted in his arrest on June 19th, 1940. And he was sentenced to 5 years in the Gulag, which is the system of forced labor camps spread throughout the Soviet Union. So the main section of the book, which we will discuss as we go along, records his torturous journey away from the civilized world to which he was accustomed and into the hell of the Gulag. There, barely surviving many harrowing experiences as a Zek, which is the Russian abbreviation for the word for a prisoner in the camp, Margolin was released in June 1945 after serving his 5 years. But he wasn't permitted to leave the Soviet Union, so he chose exile in Slavgorod in the Altai region, which is in West Siberia. He had the name there of an exile who helped him. Then, thanks to a repatriation agreement between the Soviet Union and the puppet Polish government, Margolin, who had remained a Polish citizen, was able to leave the Soviet Union in March 1946. He spent several months then in post-war Łódź in Poland while waiting for British documents that would enable him to travel to Palestine. Distressed by the destruction of the Jewish world around him there, he simultaneously described seeing the effervescent pre-war city in his mind's eye, and at the same time as he observes the post-war city without Jews. He returned to Palestine via Paris in September 1946. Upon his return, Margolin was burning with a desire to publicize the horrible truth about the Soviet Union and the gulags, and to promote freedom of emigration for Soviet Jewry. He testified, in order to advance this goal, he testified, he traveled to testify about the Soviet Union. For example, he testified in Paris, 1950-51, at the trial of David Rousset, a non-Jewish concentration camp survivor who called for an investigation of Soviet forced labor camps. Accused of lying by a French communist paper, Rousset sued the paper, and he eventually won. Margolin also spoke at the UN about Soviet labor camps, and he worked hard with Israeli organizations trying to publicize the plight of Soviet Jewry. In addition to his memoirs after his return to Palestine, Margolin wrote many articles in the 1950s and 60s in the local press in both Russian and Hebrew to advance his causes. At first, he wrote regularly for the press of the Herut Revisionist Party led by Menachem Begin, but he broke with them over several issues. For one, he felt that West Germany was no longer the enemy, and all efforts should be directed to bringing down the Soviet system and supporting the growth of democracy in West Germany as a bulwark against Soviet invasion. He also wrote works on history and philosophy. He died in Tel Aviv in 1971.
Something that comes out in a pretty interesting way in the earlier part of that memoir is the kind of the terrible set of choices that Jews in Poland faced about either accepting Soviet citizenship, or some of them actually, you know, in more or less full knowledge, went back to Germany. Is that something you could comment on for a bit, that kind of choice that those people had?
Yeah, certainly. Perhaps earlier, would you like me to say something about the history of the publication of the memoir first?
If you want to talk about that. Yeah, I wanted to get to that. So if you think it'd be best to talk about that now, certainly go ahead.
The book's origins go back to his time in camp, when he was determined to survive in order to reveal the truth about the Soviet Union and the camps. In fact, he already came to the horrible realization there that he was not just an outsider, but his experience had deformed him. He couldn't be a perfect observer, so to speak, that this was something that was going to affect his perspective for the rest of his life. And as I said, when he came back, that was the first thing to Palestine. That was the first thing he did. But even on the ship, when he was returning, prophetically, a member of the Jewish Palestinian elite, a journalist, warned him that that elite, which was pro-socialist, would probably not be very supportive of his effort. And in fact, he finished the memoir in October 1947, but he was unable to find a publisher. Indeed, the political elite both admired the Soviet Union and Stalin, and they were fearful at that time of losing Soviet support for a Jewish state. So it did not come out then. Excerpts appeared first in French translation in Paris in 1949, and then a French publishing house published an abridged version of the memoirs in 1949, entitled La Condition and Humaine, like as opposed to Malraux. In 1952, a Russian emigre publisher in New York called Chekhov Publishing House put out an even more abridged version in Russian. They were interested only in exposing Soviet atrocities, so they omitted entirely the chapters about Margolin's time in Poland before his arrest and other parts of the main story. This Russian version, however, was smuggled subsequently into the Soviet Union and circulated secretly in intelligentsia circles in the following decades, Moscow, Leningrad, and the Baltic states. And we have this mentioned by various literary critics and dissidents that it did have an effect. In the 60s and 70s, editions of the same kind of abridged editions appeared in German translation and a Russian republication. It's only much later, more recently, through the efforts of Luba Jurgensen, a literary scholar at the Sorbonne, that a full French translation of the full Russian edition was published in 2010 to critical praise. Polish, German, and Hebrew translations of this full text follows, as well as a publication in Israel of the full text in Russian, which hadn't been published before, in 2014. This current work is the first translation of the complete work in English. In addition, this book contains chapters describing Margolin's return via post-war Poland and France to Palestine. We thus have a full saga with the camp story framed by the introductory chapters in Poland, which I do think are important, and the concluding ones of his return home. So that's the history.
That's quite a story.
Yeah. We shouldn't all have such problems in getting published.
So now we looked at the overall history of the book. Then could you comment now on the question of the Jews in Poland there at that kind of chaotic moment?
Yeah, I think that's a very important part of the whole tale. I think it was a shame that it was omitted earlier. His account of events from the Nazi invasion of September 1st, 1939, until his arrest in June 1940, is both harrowing, poignant, and even at times ironic. What I think is very special is his ability to convey Polish Jews' reactions in real time. We feel with them the shock at the invasion, the chaos engendered by the government and army's incapacity, and everybody's desperation when they realize they are trapped with no avenue of escape. Together with the population in Poland, we also experience the initial failure to understand the meaning of the Soviet invasion. It was really a brutal conquest of half of Poland, but thinking that the Soviet army was coming to help them fight the Nazi invaders, Poles initially welcomed the Soviet soldiers with open arms, which now just seems impossible to imagine. People understood what was happening, however, only after the conquerors began to institute the totalitarian Soviet model that Margolin describes. Arrests, deportations, censorship, removal of cultural and political figures and institutions, suppression of Zionism, elimination of private enterprise, which led to enormous scarcities and high prices. What I also think is very touching in this section is Margolin's account of the tragic fate of various Jewish friends, such as the writer Brown, who is treated relatively well by the Soviets, but he simply cannot endure their dictatorial control of his work. He thus leaves the Soviet side and goes to his death in the Warsaw ghetto. Another friend chooses the Soviet side, accepts Soviet citizenship, and moves to a village in the Soviet sector. he too perished, but in the Pinsk ghetto after the Nazis' attack on the Soviet Union. Other Jews that he talks about returned to their families who were waiting for them on the Nazi side, and they too perished in ghettos. And Margolin feels that his telling their story is really an effort to memorialize them. They weren't like great people, but they were typical of those who suffered. However, what I also enjoyed was that there's a lighter side to the Margolin's Poland experience, which concerns the unusual jobs he performed to keep body and soul together when his escape attempts failed. The Soviet-controlled regional education department assigns him to sort through a huge collection of books transported back in Tsarist times to a Pinsk Catholic monastery, a place that had been decidedly off limits to Margolin as a young Jewish boy growing up in Pinsk. Before his arrival at the church grounds to begin work, soldiers stationed in the building had already managed to burn some of the books for fuel. His job was to establish which books were suitable for a Soviet reader, which were anti-Soviet, and which possessed bibliographical value. The highly educated Margolin was enthralled when he discovered incunabula, that is, books, valuable books printed before 1501. At the same time, Margolin impressed the Soviet censor, who wanted to know why he rejected as un-Soviet a book entitled The Theory of Darwinism. Margolin explains that the SJ before the author's name stands for Society of Jesus. And inside, the author denies that man was descended from the monkeys. Margolin resolves to leave the job when he sees his own book on Zionism on a list of works to be destroyed. Oh, that was enough for him then. So, but the fact that he refused to accept Soviet citizenship led eventually to his arrest as a socially dangerous element. They claimed that Poland was no longer a country, and therefore one could not be a citizen of Poland. And that was the horrible arrest and the start of his travels and trials in the Gulag.
One more on that book rescue project he got involved in. I remember when I was reading that part of the book, I got to wondering what treasures were lost that would change how medieval Russian history is seen.
There were old church manuscripts that were, we don't know what was lost that got burnt, of course. But there were valuable old church manuscripts, which he describes with beautiful findings, illuminated pages and so on, illuminated, pictures. So they were obviously some very valuable, but you see the Tsarist regime wanted to remove Catholics, as it was a Russian Orthodoxy. So they were trying, that's why everything was kind of moved away and just thrown into this monastery and heaped up in piles, which he had to make a special gray garment to put on them so all the dust from these books wouldn't get on him when he was working with them.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting kind of side story, really, in the overall memoir. Did a lot of that stuff get, even the stuff that he rescued, at least temporarily, do you know anything about, the long-term fate of all of those books?
No, we really don't. He certainly didn't, because he left Poland and the Soviets were in charge. We can assume that only, I mean, that the Incunabula, they obviously tried to sell and utilized it to make money. The ones that were not fit for so-called Soviet use were probably just destroyed. So only those that were deemed fit for Soviet readers were probably the ones that remained in Poland. I don't know exactly. I mean, I don't know personally what happened to the valuable books.
Yeah, I was just curious. I was wondering about that as I was reading those of us who read things for a living. You know, it kind of gets you right there, as the saying goes. You know.
Yes, indeed.
No. Well, maybe now would be a good time to comment a bit on Margolin's kind of early camp experience. You know, he's getting shipped off to fell trees and so on. Like, what kind of reactions does he have to his initial imprisonment and so on?
Well, of course, it's something even from his arrest in Poland, where, you know, he realizes in a way, as they interrogate him, that, you know, you can't reason with these people. And I mean, that his point that really he's a Polish citizen doesn't matter to them. I mean, they are interested in getting rid of a large population of people that for them are unwanted in Poland. And therefore, I mean, the Jews weren't the only ones. There were Polish nationals. He describes a whole lot of people who indeed were shipped out. Even the journey, I think he describes the journey from Poland to the forced labor camp beautifully. The chapter is called The Wandering Coffin. And he mentions that they were not just traveling in this crowded rail car. They were traveling to another dimension. They were leaving civilization, going into a dark night. And I think that's very powerful, the way he describes that. And then he gets to the camp, more surprises, all of them banned. First of all, I mean, what are the typical aspects of Soviet labor camp? The work is physically beyond his capacity and that of almost all the Poles who were sent to the Gulag with him, especially with the starvation rations that they receive. Moreover, the work is very senseless. It's often unnecessary. In fact, Tim Snyder, in the foreword to the book, notes that the sheer pointlessness of the work was in itself a source of suffering. Moreover, there's no logic to who is assigned to what job. For example, a barber can be sent to work in the field, and the farmer may be sent to be a cook. And he gives all kinds of examples of this totally illogical work assignments. No one is sent to do what they can or enjoy doing. And so that's another way of degrading the Zek. Moreover, the work norms are virtually impossible, and those, not the Poles, of course, but those like Russians who try to excel in order to get a better ration, they quickly burn out, and they wind up among the feeblest in the camp. There was a term in camp for these kind of people. They were called goners, basically. Margolin, in one of the earlier chapters, he highlights the demeaning aspect of the work in the camp. There's a word used in the camp to describe,
It's called Rav Guzh Sila, which is a combination of the Russian for manpower and horsepower. It also has intimations of the Russian word Rav, which is a slave. The word man, horsepower, Margolin observes, and I quote, joins people and animals together for work tasks and equates them in dignity, value, and destiny. Besides all that, Margolin contends that this inefficient use of manpower is also economically unprofitable. It's interesting that he's also sensitive to the disastrous ecological side of the camps. In order to build camps such as the one he was in first, Square 48, forests are brutally uprooted, leaving tree stumps, ruts, and exposed roots all over. And he writes, the roots, then again I quote, give the camp a look of convulsive mute despair, resembling those live beings who scurry among them. He's very poetic in his description. And sent to work at tree felling in the forest, Margolin sadly contrasts the beauty of the nature around them with the cruelty of the people in charge. And again, the destruction of this beautiful forest that they are forced to take part in. The most profound chapter of the book is called Dehumanization, and I think this is Margolin at his most skillful. He describes the harrowing process of losing one's possessions and one's human dignity, the loss of a link to Western civilization. Even as their possessions gradually are stolen, sold, or simply turned into rags, ironically, the Westerners still try to keep the outer signs of civilization. They still address each other as professor, doctor, and so on. But that can't last that long. They're soon reduced to wearing rags from the camp warehouse. And basically, as he says, the dehumanized Zek looks like a scarecrow with these strange clothing. The next step is eliminating all family ties. Deliberate transfers from camp to camp also make it impossible to establish any lasting friendships. Basically, what happens is one's whole past life seems like a dream, and all normal human feelings disappear or become deformed, including sexual ones. The food deprivation reduces the Zek to the level of a beast. And the loss of self-dignity and eventually of one's own will just leads to oblivion to everything but the sheer effort to survive. But that is not the end, as he says, of the dehumanization process. You have to become no longer a person, someone who will obediently echo the regime, have no personal longings, no personal feelings. And any outward signs of protest are very rare, he mentions. This is not the kind of case where you have people in camp out there protesting. They're too dehumanized for that. And any subconscious feelings that they may have are simply too deeply buried to be dangerous. They just become part of a neurosis. One thing notable about the camps, also in Margolin's time, political prisoners were not separated from the rest of the prisoners. And the foreign prisoners' downward slide was exacerbated by the presence of hardened criminals called Urki. And there's some horrible descriptions of how they rob them, threaten them, and totally humiliate them. And in fact, these Orki evokes fear even among the camp administrators who don't stop them from what they do. And this brutality and inhumanity simply deepens the hellish atmosphere of the camp. And throughout the book, Margolin emphasizes the distortion or debasement in camp of everything that is normal. No word or function means what it does in freedom. There's a medical staff, but its goal is not to serve the people who are ill. Its purpose is to keep them fit enough so that they can work no matter what. The camp as an educational sector, but Margolin remarks, being cultured means being clean and not spitting on the floor. And the books have to be guarded because prisoners try to steal them so they can tear out the paper and use it for rolling tobacco. Of course, the educational sector, its main means of educating people is propaganda and lies. And that is just carried to an incredible degree. And as I said, he notes that he himself, despite first thinking that he could be an outside observer, in this whole process, he too becomes deformed. So that anything that seems, that is, any manifestation of normality seems strange. At one point when they are coming back from the felling to camp, they see a person well-dressed driving by in a sleigh, and they can't, like, believe it. He looks normal, like this is, oh, there was a normal life. But they have to return to the horrors of the camp and the search for food. And ultimately, I would say it's this universal debasement and depletion of that all inmates suffer that is the outstanding feature of camp.
Certainly, you could really tell, you know, how deeply he has a, you know, kind of a philosophical way of looking in the world, at the world, in that it's not often you read a memoir that has such a clear thesis. I mean, normally you wouldn't expect to find a thesis in a memoir because that's not usually what memoirs do, but this one certainly has one.
Yes, yes, I would say so. As he was a philosopher, he wrote three essays in camp, but of course they were all taken away and obviously just thrown into the garbage before he, on one of his moves.
Yeah, I remember reading that section and thinking, oh no, I want to know what he said, you know.
But as he wrote afterwards, he may remember what he wrote, but it's never the same what he wrote in camp as he was feeling it in terms of even the philosophy. Even though he tried perhaps to, he tried, for example, the section on the doctrine of hate that he did try to reestablish, and that's in the memoir, if you recall.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember I wishing I could have read the original, as I'm sure other people have wished that as well. Something that stood out to me too, you were talking about how there's, you know, the unfortunate level of success that dehumanization project achieved and so on. And it struck me too that, I mean, it's not just the constant propaganda and the other dehumanizing, contacts with the criminals and so on, but struck me that a lot of it is just the outright, you can't focus on anything if you're that hungry all the time.
Yeah. I think so. He says that. I mean, that's it's a very essential part of the dehumanization when all you can think about is how you're going to get your next piece of of food. And it's also, it's very sad in some of the episodes that he describes in the camp, where there's one, for example, where he becomes very friendly with a person who, not Jewish, the person who was, what they have in common is a love of books and education, and they become friendly. But then when things just keep on going downhill, this friend steals his bread. And he doesn't, of course, admit it. And Margolin doesn't at first out and out accuse him of that, although it takes him a little sleuthing to discover that it's his friend who's stealing his bread. And at first, he does finally come out and accuse him of doing that and demand that he return to him what he owes him. And he, as he says, cruelly insists on that. And he kind of humiliates this person, and they stop being friends. Although when this teacher has really reached the final stages, they come in contact again. And Margolin, as the humanist, realizes that he was too hard on this person, and he feels terrible that he made him suffer like that, even though he himself was starving and the main focus of his life also was that piece of bread. But he feels terrible that he did this to another human being. I mean, he's very special that way.
I thought as I was reading at multiple occasions, I noticed that I found myself kind of getting sucked into his hunger and his that, you know, the author, and then of everybody else too. I remember at one point in particular, there's a scene where him and some of his fellow prisoners have discovered this stash of, I think it's potato peels or something, and he's tossed one out the back door into a snowbank, and he's hoping that it'll still be there when he gets out. And I realized partway through I was reading that chapter that I was almost kind of white knuckling the book as I was holding it, hoping that he was going to get his potato peel. And I was realizing that I was feeling extremely hungry myself, just reading about his hunger. Is that, I don't know, is that, would you, to me, that was one of the most effective things about the book, was how he really kind of brings you into that mode of living. Is that something that you found to be true as well as you've been translating it?
Yes, I think that's one of his most successful techniques. I mentioned it in the earlier part in Poland, where you don't have hindsight. You feel what's going on, the chaos. You don't know what's going to happen next. Am I going to be better off staying on the Soviet side or going to the Nazi side? The Jews did not know at the time. I think that technique also works successfully in camp. Yes, I'm going to try and sneak certain food items. There was this fish that some of the men sneak out of a warehouse, and some manage to start eating and others don't. There's always this, are they going to succeed? And it's because he's describing it in a very much of the present tense. And he doesn't tell you the outcome. You're waiting to find out. I think that's a very successful technique.
You know, something that stood out to me as another big theme in there. I was wondering if you could comment on this. He chronicles this progressive dehumanization and so on, and that's kind of the pessimistic side of the book, I suppose. But then, you know, there's an optimistic side too, where it, at multiple stages, you know, chance encounters with people who take a human interest in him, you know, save his life on multiple occasions. He certainly wouldn't have made it out without those people. So I guess what I'm wondering here is, I mean, do you, in light of those kind of encounters, which maybe you could speak to as well, mean, is this ultimately a hopeful book that, that in the long run, you know, individuals being good to each other can triumph under any kind of circumstances?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't mind talking about that in the context of the book's value altogether today, if you don't mind.
Okay. Yeah, that would be great.
I think the book is very timely. Yes, it's important as a historical record. As I said, it tells us how people felt then in Poland. It tells us how people felt in the Soviet camp, which, of course, is something that some people now are trying to airbrush, let's say, out of history books. But I think the most important thing is that this book, like any classic literary book, is really timeless. And it's true that we hear some pretty terrible things. And he describes in very heartbreaking detail the steps by which this totalitarian system succeeds in destroying, not just in the camp, but even outside, everything that makes an individual human. And what I think is very timely is, unfortunately, such regimes have certainly not disappeared throughout history. And for today, for example, we can mention the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs. If you've read what they do in those camps, it's the same attempts at rehabilitation, but it's basically to destroy people and to change them. So I think that everything there is very apt. But what the other thing that I think you're very right about the positive side. For one thing, the message that he wants to convey is one of respect and tolerance for every human being, in a very universalist sense. And he insists on the need to expose all injustice and all totalitarian regimes. And what's interesting in that sense, I think, is that although he mentions the anti-Semitism found among many nations, despite that, he sympathizes with the national aspirations of different nationalities in the camp who were oppressed under the Soviet system. For example, Ukrainians, Georgians, Belarusians, and Poles. And he becomes friendly with them. He learns from one of them all about Ukrainian culture and history. And he wishes all of them national freedom in the future. He's even tolerant for some of the really unattractive characters in the book, because he realizes that their misfortune is just as profound as that of anyone else. And what you said, I think, is also important, because when I talk to people about the subject matter of the book, they sometimes are apprehensive that it's depressing. But I think with you that ultimately, especially at a time like ours where things seem rather dispiriting, that its ultimate message is uplifting. In the final section, the return to the West, while Margolin is waiting in Marseille for his ship to Palestine, he reads two works by Jean-Paul Sartre, Being and Nothingness and La Nausée, and he is repelled by what he sees as impotent nihilism, a lack of will that, in his view, enabled a Nazi conquest of Europe. He exclaims, and I'm quoting, "I wanted to live. I felt strength and future possibilities within myself, and it was a source of joy." And he felt overwhelmed by a feeling of life in and around himself. And he calls in the book on the rest of mankind to join him in a struggle to uproot real evil. And in that sense, he is telling us today, yes, hell is real, but you must stand up and fight for what you believe in. He remains optimistic that good can triumph.
Yeah, that certainly stood out to me, that thesis of his, as he's talking about the various doctors who befriended him and you know, protected him at various points. How he manages to find, you know, good people in these kind of terrible overall circumstances. I thought that was pretty impressive, how he manages to strike that note of hope inside that overall context.
Yeah, I think that's very true, and that he is truly a humanist, because he can see the good in almost every human being. And given how oppressive his situation was, that's a very rare ability.
Yeah, I certainly thought so. I was wondering, I got to the end of the book, and I found myself really kind of disappointed in that he didn't talk at all about what his actual reunion with his family was like. The book ends while he's kind of still on the boat, just about home, as I recall. And I was wondering if that was something you could fill me in on here. I don't recall off the top of my head how old his son was when he left, but of course his son would have barely known him, I think. And what was his reunion with his wife and his son like?
We don't have a description, but we do know his wife was a very, also very special, very welcoming person. I read a brief little memoir, written not that long ago, where some woman described the home that they had in Tel Aviv, that they were always welcoming people all the time. There were always guests. They were always very hospitable. The actual reunion with the family, I don't know. Obviously, it was not easy for his son to have the father away for so long. Incidentally, his son Ephraim, who is now 94, is living in California.
I was wondering about that.
I was told that, and he very much wanted to see the English publication of his father's memoir. For him, it was very important. He has been active in Zionist causes. Like his father, when he was in Israel, he was active in the party that was not in the ruling regime at the time. That was the days of the labor control of the political arena. And he never succeeded he was a lawyer. He didn't succeed in getting a satisfactory job. And that's why he now lives in California. And he has two children and two grandchildren. But I do think the English edition was very important to him. And I think it's very important that people, I think it's a classic literarily. I mean, he just knows how to hone in on the characteristics of an individual, on the human side of an individual, on the foibles of an individual, but to describe it all so acutely, I think it is really worth reading for anybody who enjoys literature.
Maybe wrapping up here, it occurs to me a good way to kind of bring things to a close might be, so he's got several big ideas in play over the course of the book. He's got his thesis about dehumanization. He's got this, periodic entrances and exits of people who manage to remain human in spite of themselves, or in spite of their surroundings, I should say. I was wondering, is there a particular scene from the book that you think just, I don't know, really encapsulates what he's trying to do in the book that you could share with the listeners, one that really stands out in your mind as kind of putting it all together?
I think it's hard to, because there's so many instances. I mean, it's kind of amazing. He went through so many jobs in the camp, and in each crazy job, he manages to point out not just that it was difficult or impossible, but to point out what it does to one's humanity, how one becomes treated like an animal or whatever it is. He points to the human side of every encounter in the book, and there are so many. So I don't know. I would have to think to pick out one in particular, because I really think there are so many. He describes all these different people, all these encounters. I think the most, again, as I said, I think the most important thing is that optimistic message in the end, that one can and should use one's life to the best of one's own ability and to the benefit of mankind as a whole, and not to give up and fight real evil.
Yeah, I certainly got that message, which you can kind of, you know, juxtapose with the mental image of the author kind of futilely banging his axe against a tree or whatever else it is he's doing in the course of those various camp jobs.
You know, there was one thing though that I might mention that I thought was kind of touching, and it exemplifies the whole absurdity of the camp system. They're out there felling trees, and they have a short break, a half hour, whatever it is, and they don't even have lunch. All they get is a little hot water, but they get to rest. And his companions are there in a circle. And what do? They don't fall asleep. They ask if somebody could explain Einstein's theory of relativity.
I remember that.
And they have a discussion about it. These men who are being worked beyond human endurance, being fed nothing, and living in filth and disgust. They want to discuss Einstein's relativity during their break. Now, I think that's kind of amazing.
And kind of hopeful, too, really. It's something about us that's fundamentally unkillable, no matter what the circumstances may be, I think.
Yes, I agree with you. Yeah.
Is there anything that you'd like to tell everybody about the book that you haven't had a chance to do as of yet?
I think I pretty much covered everything. I say read the book. It's very, very worthwhile, and it's beautifully written by a very special humanist.
Yes, and I would echo that too. Any book that can bring you into an author's circumstances at that level is very much worth reading. So thank you for being with us, Stephanie. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will be interested enough to read Margolin for themselves.
Thank you very much for your interview and for your understanding, your deep understanding of the work. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Certainly. So thanks again for being with us, and we'll sign off here.
Okay. Bye-bye.